You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hurlan. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished investor and ex-fund manager, Jamie Ward. So welcome, Jamie.
Hi, Paul. How you doing?
Yeah, not bad. Well, thanks a lot for coming back onto the show, especially given all the sort of volatility of late. So maybe we can start there. Is the sort of recent V-shaped rally in equities, is it sustainable or is it more of a dead cat bounce? What's your sort of thoughts?
Obviously markets do tend to sort of wave up and down a bit anyway. I don't perceive a risk of like a major bear market, like that preceding the kind of, like you say, a dead cat bounce into a major bear market, just because we know for the last 15 years, whenever there's been any kind of risk to capital markets, liquidity just floods the system. And, you know, there is the argument that, well, we're in a much more inflationary environment these days, so perhaps central bankers are going to be reluctant to flood the system quite so much. But I'm just not convinced central banks are as independent as they once were, or they may never have been particularly independent. It just may have been in the past that central banks happen to have views that happen to be in line with politics. I suspect their central banks' views and aims have gone divergent to the views and aims of political classes, and I don't just mean Trump. I mean it's all over the place. But I just can't imagine any political leader out there, any of the sort of, you know, major ones like Trump, out there watching markets decline and going, yeah, we'll just let that happen. I just think they'll sort of, you know, whatever, put the thumb down on the central banks and make them flood the system, because they've done it so much in the past. So they're just like, well, why not just do it again?
And I think you're spot on there. I mean, there's no doubt about it. When we had those 2nd of April tariffs, since then, Trump has pivoted and reduced those, particularly with China, down to 10% to the rest of the world and 30% for China. So that's sort of like ratcheted. What position as passives played into this rally? Because obviously, if you've got extra liquidity, then, you know, sort of like that whole sort of like, you know, passive trade plus the sort of like, you know, for investors, should people go into passives or should they go into actives or run their own portfolio?
Yeah, you see, I have so many views on the passive active thing. I mean, passives has been the kind of predominant place for new and marginal capital probably for at least 20 years now, but it's really ramped up in the last 10 years. And I think it's had this effect of effectively corrupting the market. So there is areas where liquidity goes towards, and there's certain equities or other securities that always just seem to get more and more of the flows, and hence their valuations get higher and higher and higher. And I think we talked about it 4 or 5 months ago when I was on last, how like your Mag 7 type things just carried on pushing higher, and it was partly because of passive. But there's areas that always seem to get left behind. That said, in the last sort of, where are we now? We're sort of 3rd week of May, and I think the markets began to really start to decline at the start of April. So in the last seven or eight weeks, you had this horrible decline, but actually everything seems to have gone up. You know, one of the companies we're going to talk about later, I noticed this morning it's up 20% since the end of April. my big issue with the passive active thing is people seem to have forgotten what the point of capital markets is. We have got to the situation where it's all about the end investor, and the regulator and various sort of interested parties, shall we say, like your BlackRock and people like that, are really interested in making sure that the cost of investing is as low as possible. But I've got rid of the kind of price discovery component, because price discovery is done by the active side. At its heart, capital markets exist as a symbiosis between those who need capital and those who provide capital. And the providers of capital are called investors, but those who need capital are called, you know, businesses and companies and stuff like that. So, you know, I could find probably 50 companies right now that are all quite good, that have got really, really high cost of capital, i.e. their equities are super, super cheap. And it means that if they want to invest, but they need more capital, there's no point in coming to equity markets anymore. Because the cost of raising money is so high, it's just sort of like, oh, why bother? And you can really see it in like the number of companies that are still listed. I think there was 2,000 companies on the London Stock Exchange at the start of COVID. There's like 1,600 now.
Yeah.
And it just seems every week there's one, maybe two are getting delisted. I think there was two in one day last week. Or it might be, last week, like Thursday or something. Yeah, okay, fine. Well, there were takeovers. But the problem is passives is sort of sucking up all of the money, and then we're losing the price discovery component, and we're losing the cost of capital. And it's like, what are we doing here? What's the point of capital markets if they don't reflect reality?
But when it comes to sort of investors, where should they put their money? Passives, actives, or run their own book?
Well, obviously it depends on the kind of sophistication of the investor. And this is a difficult thing. As much as I dislike passives, actually for a lot of people, probably best off just in some sort of world tracker. I would like to say actually most people should take a view on a particular fund manager or a particular set of companies that fulfill their criteria. Yeah. But that requires really kind of upskilling people who, you know, they've got better things to do with their lives. Imagine the kind of people.
Really? That's not possible, is it?
Well, I wouldn't say so, but then again, I'm a bit of a savvy.
Do you run all your money, or do you use
active? I've been a professional investor for 20 years. And I mean, you ask my wife, I'm an obsessive. You know, I'll be on holiday and I'll be looking at companies. I'll be going on long walks with my son and I'll be thinking about investing. You know, I'm not a good man.
Join the club. Fantastic. Yeah.
But okay. I think a lot of people who watch this are probably in the same boat. So those kind of people, yeah, they don't want to be in passives. They want to be, you know, taking a view on things.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, if anybody wants to ask Jamie any questions, please put them in the chat box. We've got a couple already. Let's go for one we talked about last time. Let's go for Wise, which is basically an international money payments provider. Listed a few years back, run by pretty much an iconic founder. I think it's got a couple of sort of golden shares. The business has actually been on a tear of late, taking market share away from the traditional banks for that international payments, and also outsourcing its payment rails to other banks for international payments. I think it's got Morgan Stanley and Standard Chartered is also doing these type of transfers as well. Anyway, what's your sort of latest update on Wise? Really top quality poster child of the sector listed in the UK.
Yeah, so I've been fairly vocal about Wise, and I've referred to it as like the Amazon of finance, but I think I'm worried that people have misinterpreted exactly what I've meant there. Now, I sort of haven't done myself a favour completely on this one, because I wrote about Wise in Money Week around Christmas time. And in that time, I did say, you know, they started off with foreign currency transfer, but also you can effectively use Wise like a bank now, because you can have your current accounts there. You can actually invest there if you want, including direct equity. So it almost acts as like a kind of total financial solution for people. But that's not super actually what I meant. Yeah, exactly. But that's not exactly what I meant. I mean, that's partly what I meant, how, you know, Amazon started selling books, but that was never the end goal. It was always going to be, you know, as Brad Stone referred to it, the everything store. Now, Wise might go down that route, but what I really meant with Wise, being like the Amazon of finance, is their attitude towards long-term value creation and the way that he being Christo Klarman, the CEO, thinks about the business and competitive advantage. So one of the things that has held Wise back in valuation terms is their mission statement is to make foreign currency transfer free. Now, we talked about last time why they can still make money when it's free, because you have money on deposit with them when you're making transfers. And if they get to a point where they're transferring, and this is my estimate, but if they're transferring somewhere around £1.5 trillion a year, it's big money, but you know, I'm sure they can get there. At that point, I think they can be free, because the amount they'll be earning off deposits will be so much that it pays for the entire business. But I think people have missed the point. I think when people look at Christo going, we're making it cheaper every year, we're already the cheapest, and then one day we're going to be free. I don't think what he's saying is, I'm going to be some great philanthropist that's trying to create this app that makes it all free and everything. I think what he's doing is the same thing that Jeff Bezos was always doing back in the 90s and early 2000s, when it was constantly investing in tech, constantly trying to push the flywheel around. And he deliberately uses this analogy to a flywheel, because that entrenches your competitive advantage. I suspect that Wise is already in a situation where their competitive advantage is insurmountable. But then by throwing money at tech, throwing money at scale, throwing money at growth constantly, it makes their competitive advantage so insurmountable that it effectively becomes the global way of doing things. And I think that's where Wise is going. It's like the Amazon of finance, in the sense that it's the same attitude towards price and customer service that Bezos, and Bezos wasn't the first, but everyone knows Amazon. Fewer people might, you know, would know like Costco or something, which had the same sort of attitude. Ultimately, there are two types of companies in this world. There are companies that make money because they try and maximize the amount they can charge for things. And there's currency companies that try and minimize the amount they can charge for things. And intuitively, the former seem the best, because they're trying to increase their returns on capital. But they're always a threat to someone who's coming behind them trying to be cheaper. The ones that are already trying to be cheaper are never threatened. And that's where the really biggest, most powerful, most profitable businesses come from. It's that obsession with being the cheapest, not the most expensive. And that's what Wise is.
Yeah. Well, I use Wise for both myself, personal account and business account. When we spoke last time, I thought, right, okay, let's try it out. It's excellent. It really is. It's anecdotal evidence. I mean, I can't sort of like praise it high enough. Really, really good. But when just coming back to that original price discovery, if you look at the actual, sort of like valuation of Wise, it trades at roughly around just under 7x sales, 30x PE. I know it's growing at 30%. I mean, when it comes to price discovery for Wise, what is that price value equation at the moment? I mean, it's trading at what, nearly 11 quid.
Yeah, you see that it's such a difficult thing to answer. I mean, I know they're basically guiding to sort of 25% per annum growth for the medium term. And I think they're saying the medium term is because if they said the long term, it would look arrogant. Where I actually think they could probably grow at 25% per annum, 10 years, 15 years, maybe. I don't know, maybe even 20 years. I don't know. The thing is, if you're growing at 25% per annum, you're doubling your earnings every 3 years. So if they do it for 6 years, you've quadrupled your earnings and your 30x PE becomes 7.5.
Yeah.
I don't really know what the right price for Wise is, but I know it's not going to grow at 25% per annum for 6 years and then stop. So 7x FY6, which is 2031, I think that's far too cheap. I think, yeah. I mean, I don't know what the right number is. It is reality, because...
To give you an indication, the sort of like the indicative valuations for things like, I know they're different businesses, but when you look at PayPal, even Block, Equals got taken out at roughly anywhere between sort of like, you know, 12 to 15 times PE. PayPal may be slightly higher at about 18 times, but we're talking less than 20 times PE for effectively, you know, your payment businesses.
Yeah, well, I think it's a set above all those. I think none of them can do what Wise can do. I don't think anyone can do what Wise can do, because they've spent so long trying to get to this competitive position.
Yeah,
and it means that their long term growth rate is at a much higher sustainable rate. I say it again, I don't really know what the right number is, but I do have I do believe that if Wise was listed on the Nasdaq, it wouldn't be, I don't know, 11, 12 billion market cap. It would be 80, 90 billion market cap.
Yeah.
Because American tech investors would look at this and realize what it is. I mean, it's notable to me that the second biggest holder after Christo is Andreessen Horowitz, and they've got a board member on there as well. And, you know, I don't know how much they put in it, but they've got a holding that's probably worth pushing $1 billion now.
Yeah.
And they're clearly holding on because they're the kind of investors who know what Wise is. I mean, I think in the UK, there's nothing like it.
Yeah.
There's no business that exists that has the potential to be as special as this.
Yeah.
That's not to say that there aren't going to be other businesses that do similar percentage returns over the next 10-15 years. I just haven't discovered them.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, let's switch sectors. Go to luxury consumer. We've got Burberry, quite a controversial stock. Some people love it, some people hate it. You've got some quite famous fund managers in there who have been talking the tune. It's going through a bit of a turnaround. New CEO came out with results or trading update yet last week saying that the rate of decline had reduced, which was good news across the world, but was still going down, largely because I think they just sold off a shed load of old sort of stock, etc. What's your sort of latest on Burberry?
Well, I felt like I needed to talk about it again because I did mention it last time, and I bought it in October. You can see it on that chart for about £7.
Yeah.
And then I managed to sell it more or less exactly at the peak in February.
Good time.
I think there's a bit of luck. Also, I think there's a bit of luck. There's a lot of luck involved there. I had used technicals as my entry and my exit, although I did know the business very well because I used to hold it in my old fund. My concerns with Burberry is its style is very counter trend at the moment. The current trend is for, well, two things: casual and cropped. And what Burberry make? Very smart long coats, which doesn't really fit. But, you know, fashion is very cyclical. We will come back to Burberry at some point and it will be worth a lot more in the future. It's whether a kind of big luxury goods conglomerate like an LVMH gets there for the investors. The only concern I have is it's a lot more China than people realize. I think about 50% of the business is down as Asia Pacific. And obviously a big chunk of that is China. But it's not. It's just not true. Yes, only around 50% of the business of the sales are done in stores in Asia Pacific region. But you only have to go in Burberry in London or one of the Burberry stores in London. And there are signs in Chinese everywhere. And funny enough, a lot of the consumers are Chinese. So even the stuff that's being sold in the UK, a lot of it is actually being sold to the Far East. I don't know what's going on with China, but I do know that especially since this tariff stuff started, even though it's supposed to be a US phenomenon, there's been all sorts of sort of videos coming out from apparently Chinese content creators, but I just don't believe there's such a thing as an independent content creator in China. I feel like to become big in China, you need to have government backing. And they're all kind of going, oh, here's such and such a coat, like a Burberry coat or whatever. You pay £3,000 for it. It says it's made in, are they made in England? I assume they probably must be.
They are, the factory's in England.
But then they'll point out, there'll be Chinese channels that go, look, here's everything made, and then we ship it off to Britain and they sew it together. And it's like, and that is true of LVMH stuff. It's true of all sorts of stuff. And I feel like there's some sort of partially bolstering of Chinese made goods and partly kind of denigrating Western luxury goods. And I do worry that the luxury sort of bubble is not bubble, that's not the right word, but luxury sort of trend has sort of played out now. And actually we're probably in a long-term declining industry for luxury goods. So it does look very cheap. Its balance sheet's pretty sound, and
it's not cheap. It's on 50 times PE.
Yeah, okay. If you normalize its earnings capacity for based upon the amount of assets it's got
historically,
that's always been my big thing about valuation is everyone can look at the E and go, well, look at the P compared to the E. That's cheap or expensive. But you really need to think about where you're sitting in the cycle of returns on capital, and I think it's a low end of returns on capital.
Yeah.
but ultimately, like, I'm not interested to go back in it, even though I could have bounced a load more money back in, because I think it went, I went down to about £5.50 and it's back up to about £8. Like, I mean, the volatility in Burberry is enormous. But basically, I wanted to return to it because I told people I was in it last time, and I actually sold it about 4 weeks after I was on last time. Yeah, and okay. I'm not tempted to go back in. And I feel like even the fact that it was probably my single greatest investment in that I made 40% in about 3 months, I'm not convinced I did the right thing anyway.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's move on. We're staying fashion. We've got a question from Ben Sharman. I don't know whether you've got any knowledge on this or own it. We've got JD Sports, the sports fashion business. We'll talk about another one in that sector. But just first of all, in JD Sports, got a big business in the States. The shares have actually bounced of late, having had a bit of a ski slope for the last 12 months.
Yeah, historically, it was always a very well-run business. There was a guy called, I struggle to remember his name now, but it was the guy that turned around Reebok in the 1980s. I think he bought the Reebok brand in about 1980 for 400,000 quid and sold it for 100 million in 1990. And he used that as a kind of springboard to invest in various things. And he has this thing called the Pentland Group. What's his name? Do you know what I mean? Pentland Group guy.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, but wasn't it Whelan, the guy called Whelan and the family who basically set this up originally?
That was JJB, I think.
Yeah, isn't it part of JD?
He might be. You're thinking of Dave Whelan, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I thought it's part of what JD Sports, basically the same sort of thing, that model anyway.
Yeah, well,
they've been buying, but they bought a business in the States. They trade on roughly round about PE ratio, 8x PE going forward.
Yeah, it certainly looks cheap. Anyway, I was getting with the Pentland guy. He bought 50-odd% of the business and put in a CEO and CFO in like the early 2000s, and they really nailed it. Like they ran that so well. They rolled it out, and it's rolled out internationally, and then they made a few acquisitions. But now none of that's really – it's not the same people anymore. And it was the same people that made that US acquisition. I think the business was called Finishing Line or Finish Line.
Yes, okay.
And the problem with doing business in US retail is something I've observed from being a US analyst of stock of US companies, analyst of US companies, is – really well-run businesses in America are 10 a penny. In the UK, we are in awe of Simon Wolfson. In the US, he'd be one of 50. And it makes operating against those guys incredibly difficult. So I think JD Sport has struggled in the US. I haven't followed it that closely in the last few years, but I think it's struggled in the US. And I don't think there's enough growth or low-hanging fruit for it to go at anymore.
Yeah.
That said, it's clearly very cheap.
Yeah. Okay, good. So it's got that good value metrics, but needs to move its top line there, Ben. In terms of the one I know you do like, Frasers, another iconic owner, founder, Mike Ashley. He owned Newcastle for a short period, the football club. Sports Direct, it's well known for, but has been buying a shed load of other sort of like other brands. Or part of it, but it's got part of Hugo Boss, I think. It's got part of Boohoo and Revolution Beauty and a whole lot of other sort of like, you know, sort of like minorities. Anyway, how do you see this one? It's, again, a bit of a Marmite stock.
Yeah, well, that's the point. It's very Marmite. And it's going through one of those periods where everyone hates Marmite. Should we say it like that?
I always liked it as a kid.
I love it. You call it a Marmite thing. You know, we know what we mean.
We do. Yeah, exactly.
Frasers is a far better business than people think it is. It went through a rough period in the mid-2010s. They had issues with staffing at the Shirebrook warehouse. And the then CEO, a guy called Dave Forsey, had to fall on his sword. And you can see it falling off in 2016 on that chart there.
Yeah.
And it's taken a few years to turn back around. But Dave Forsey had to leave at the time. And Mike actually stepped back in as CEO. And they spent a few years basically trying to turn it around, to right-size it, to get it to the situation it is now. So that he can step back and give the reins to his son-in-law, a guy called Michael Murray. Yeah, Michael Murray. No, Matthew Murray. People denigrate Mike Ashley. It's like, oh, he's a bit of a chancer. It's all debt-fueled, which isn't true. You know, he's it's all stack of my, sell it cheap. Reality is he set this business up when he was 18 years old. He just turned 18 with a 10 grand loan. He operated as a sole trader for 17 years when it was already a massive business. Imagine a massive business as a sole trader. I don't know how he got around that, but he did. And then he listed it when he was like 42 or something. It's now a business generating about 600 million a year in EBIT, so operating profit. And it was more or less entirely set up by this guy. To denigrate him as an idiot and a chancer is absurd. Like, by most measures, he's probably one of, if not the most successful entrepreneur in British history. But he sort of, he's hated by the city for whatever reason. Now we're in a period where it's actually a lot better business than it was in 2016, and it's getting better all the time. So what Frasers is, it's a really well invested, technologically enabled business. It's, you know, automated warehouses and all that kind of stuff, with a really, really good finance arm that has effectively, in the same way that Next has done it, has turned itself into a retail platform. And they've had to do it for a different reason. Next has done it because Next was the original bricks and clicks business. And we'll get onto Next in detail in a minute. Frasers has done it because they've been very acquisitive. And Frasers' main way of doing acquisitions is wait until something's bombed out and then buy it for pennies on the pound. But in doing that, it meant that they had to learn how to integrate different retail businesses into the same coherent model, which they've developed over the years to the point now where they are, as I say, effectively a retail platform. That makes Frasers a much, much better business than I think people realise. So much so that if you look at Frasers' sports retail part of the business, the thing that used to be called Sports Direct, and I think at the high street it basically still is called Sports Direct, in profitability terms, it rivals Next, the most profitable retailer in the UK. Frasers is up there. In terms of the ability to fulfill and do all the technological side of things, it rivals Next. But it's on, I mean, according to my measure, it's on about a 60% discount to M&S, which has been a rubbish business for 25 years. Yeah. That doesn't make sense.
I don't think the city hate it because of Mike Ashley. I think they basically, the question is should it be listed? Because the way he likes running it is such that it's his business and everybody else should give him a chance to do whatever he wants to do. And it's just a corporate governance, because most other businesses are run for, you know, in a certain set way, particularly big businesses which are in the FTSE, whereas he wants, it's a question, should it be listed or not, really?
Yeah, and that's certainly an argument. And the way things are going, it's not going to be. It's because it's so cheap. They've been apportioning probably a quarter of their free cash flow to buying back shares the last few years. And as a result, they've bought back 15%. The thing is that he owned 60% 3 years ago. They're only buying back the free float. So he's bought back 15% of the whole business. He's now owned 73% without having bought any more. If they carry on the way they are, in less than 10 years, it will be a private business because they'll have bought everything back and cancelled it, which obviously can't
happen. As soon as you get to 75, you can basically delist, can't you?
Yeah. You have to, you know, I mean, that's what, what's the guy called? Rothermere did with DMGT. And minority shareholders, they'll do okay out of it. And that's the big risk with Frasers, is it gets delisted and minority shareholders get a 20% bump. Whereas in reality, I think, you know, last 10 years, they've increased their book value by about 10% per annum. Since listing, 16% per annum. If they can maintain their earnings capacity, carrying increasing by 10% per annum, and their valuation goes up to something like what Marks and Spencer's is on, the next 10 years, you're looking at 500 or 600%.
Yeah. I think Mike actually needs to step back. If it all depends on whether he wants to run it himself the way a normal
one. In practice, we know he hasn't.
Yeah. Okay, good. We've got a question. You may not own it, but it's a broader question from Stefan. He's asking about the UK house builders and Vistry in particular, which is a affordable housing manufacturer, or basically builder. It's about 2/3 affordable social housing on sort of like big projects and contracts for the housing associations, and then does its own sort of like homes as well, sort of home build, etc. Been through a number of problems, had a lot of big contracts, particularly in its southern region. trades at roughly around about, I think it's around about net book assets, actually, net tangible assets, £6.10. Don't know if you've got any quick thoughts on it at all.
Yeah, I actually think it might be at a discount. I'm not sure, but yeah. I really want to like Vistry. I think we mentioned last time, they're effectively trying to turn themselves into NVR, which is a US house builder, which is all contract house building. Yes. And the great thing about contract house building is your balance sheet's much quicker. So you can run much lower margins and still have much higher returns on capital. In theory, if they can do it, they should be able to get returns on capital in excess of 30%. And if your returns on capital are 30% and your cost of capital is, let's say, 8%, then you should be trading at 3.5 times book. And as you say, even if they're at book, that means that they've got 350% upside from here, or I suppose 250% upside. But and if they're trading at a discount, like I think they might be, then it's even higher. The problem is I just don't trust UK house builders, and it's not the businesses as such. But I've never met a house builder executive that I've come away with a good feeling about. I think for me the big thing was Vistry wasn't part of it, or as it was at the time. Was it Barrel, Bede, Bellweg, never mind which it is, but back in 2011, 2010, when they were all trading at fractions of their book value, Barclay Homes and Persimmon, and I think one other, had their what do they call it? It was like a It was basically a long-term incentive plan for the executives.
Yes, I remember.
All they had to do was pay massive special dividends, yes, and the executives got tens of millions. And I think the highest, one person got over 100 million. And I just thought, if you're that cheap, you should be buying back your equity, not robbing the companies. And it just leaves a bitter taste with me with house builders. So, I mean, I shouldn't have said any of that, really, because this is all recorded. But I just don't trust house builder executives.
No. So, I'll just add to that, Stefan. I mean, the thing is with Vistry, because it's got 2/3 exposure now to affordable homes, the big problem you have is that the housing associations, most of them are almost bust, and they've actually got to pay a lot of cladding fines out, or penalties and remuneration. So that's the funding. Their customer, their target customer, hasn't actually got much money until the government actually gives them some cash to be able to invest in social housing. So actually the growth in all these affordable homes is actually struggling at the moment because their customer hasn't got enough money. That may change with the building safety levy, which comes out, which is targeting private sales to fund social sales through the cladding rebalancing. And they may also, the government, to get their 1.5 million social houses built, essentially, they may give them more money. But until they do, it's going to be slow progress in that whole social housing, would be my take. Okay, yeah. Let's move sectors. We've got one which is another really sort of controversial one. We've got RWS. It's a language translation business. It's got big exposure into the life sciences with patent translation, real specialist skills, and also lots of regulated markets. So it's going to be very difficult for AI to swap out those skills, but it has had a bit of impact on the lower value type of translations for websites and stuff. RWS joined with SDL about 4 or 5 years ago. Shares have really got bombed out for the last 2 or 3 years. But the CEO just bought, after its previous trading update, about $600,000 worth of shares. So he's confident. What's your sort of take on this? Is this going to be a fallen angel coming back as a phoenix?
There might be an element of that, but I wouldn't stick with it. AI is revolutionizing anything related to human algorithmic behavior. Let's put it like that. The pattern translation is a perfect example. You know, you want to change a pattern from Portuguese law in Portuguese language to Japanese law in a Japanese language. You need a very highly technical set of skills. No, you don't. You used to. Now you need AI. And that concerns me with something like RWS, because their big kind of competitive advantage was the fact that they had this whole sort of workforce of hugely, hugely skilled people in both linguistics and technical knowledge. And it effectively meant they were the people who could do the jobs for you. And I think AI it's one of those businesses that AI has probably got the clearest threat towards. I know what you said about the regulated businesses, but regulated businesses are only not threatened by AI until the regulation changes. You see what I mean?
Well, I think what they do basically is translate the detailed engineering specs and the key documentation and the terms and the jargon used in that industries into specific legal sort of like tight defined procedures and for safety purposes. So you can't, it means that the, you can't really be, you know, inaccurate. It has to be 100% correct, particularly when an educated person in that sector is reading it.
Yeah, but I don't see why that may. I feel like that vastly erodes any long term competitive advantage RWS has had, because it's like, who was I talking to? I was talking to someone recently about it's a different area, but financial advisors, IFAs and stuff. And I was saying, you know, an intermediate financial advisor, probably 90% of their casework is actually just doing the work. And that can all be done by AI now. What you need them for is the 10% of just making sure everything's correct and doing the bedside manner stuff. And I feel like that's probably what RWS will be left with at the end, the economic value of which is greatly diminished from where it was a few years ago. That said, it probably is cheap, as for the same reason that everything on AIM is cheap, is that you have a constant sort of exodus of capital. And it doesn't get any new capital because all the marginal capital is going into passives, and AIM doesn't get any passives.
Yeah. Is it a buy or a sell here, Jamie?
Oh, I'm not a trader. It's a trading stock, and I'm not a trader, which is why.
But I mean, is it a buy or sell as an investment?
I would sell it. Because if you sell it and watch it go up by fourfold, you'll be annoyed with yourself, which is why you need to sell it and not look at it.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to maybe an advertising special, which you may think it's a buy. I'm not sure. Is Brave Bison? Basically, they've been quite acquisitive of late. And there's a couple of guys, I think, who run it very entrepreneurial, et cetera. And they're also looking to buy, or, you know, they may buy the mini MBA business Central Media, et cetera. How do you see this one? They use a lot of endorsers, I think, to help promote companies.
Yeah, there is an element of that. So, I talked about these a few months ago, and I thought it's probably a good idea to update. So since I saw you last, I actually went to go and see them, Ollie and Theo. Okay. And they were very generous at the time. They gave me 2 hours. I just sort of sat in their office, just sort of just to give me a chance of sort of seeing the whites of their eyes to see if I could understand them and what motivated them and what they were trying to achieve. And it was very clear that what they're trying to achieve is to generate as much shareholder value as possible. Partly because they will own 30% of the bit, or 29.9% of the business when their options come in, but they own like 19% of the business or something at the moment. The thing about what they do, that influencer thing, I mean, that's just something they've acquired. Everything they've done is stuff they've acquired. But they're basically trying to do a top-to-bottom digital advertising business. So they can do everything from the kind of creative stuff right through to the kind of buying and everything in the middle. And it's quite a diverse set of operations given its size. One thing I would say about them is they are trying to do buy and build, and where their competitive advantage is coming from is they're in a sector where people often run advertising businesses like lifestyle businesses, because you get somebody who goes out and wins a big contract, and then you dine out on that big contract, and you know, you live a very nice life. And, you know, having a lifestyle business when you're the person who owns the business, especially one that's very profitable, can be a very nice place to be. You know, you make $500,000 a year, not having to work particularly hard for it because you've already done the work in the past. You can see why people sort of rest on their laurels. You don't want to be invested in one, though, because all the rewards effectively go to the employees. And that's not what's happening with Brave Bison. You know, they barely pay themselves. I say barely pay themselves. They pay themselves $100,000 a year. Which, considering 10 years ago, when it was a much smaller business, the previous managers were paying themselves $200,000 a year. It does sort of show you that they aren't paying themselves very much. They only really benefit when the shareholder benefits, because they have options that are based purely on the share price.
So what did you, so overall, these two guys, what did you make of them? Are they somebody to couple of brothers back?
I think they're the real deal. I think they're making really intelligent acquisitions. And the thing about the acquisitions is they're not paying as much as it looks like they're paying. If you take the example of Engage, I'm not sure how much I can tell you exactly on this one, but they bought this business called Engage in December. And the headline was, Brave Bison pays £10 million for Engage. Do you want to know how much they actually paid for Engage? £25,000.
Yeah, okay.
They paid £25,000 and they took on just under £2 million in debt. So effectively, they paid £2 million. And then there's about £8 million worth of, if they really, really smash their targets, then the people they bought it off make more money. But they're not those targets aren't going to get hit. So they paid £2 million. And the reason you do this in advertising is because if you're an engaged client, you look at it and go, we were a client of this great business that was worth £10 million. And now we're a client of this great business that can afford to pay £10 million. Whereas if the headline was, well, they paid £25,000 and they took on the debt, it's like, well, that doesn't look quite so good. And that's not uncommon in this sector. I mean, if they buy Centaur for £10 million, it will be not Centaur, the mini MBA stuff. But then again, that's a proper business. Well, £20 million, but that's a big proper business.
Yeah.
It's a good business and they really know what they're doing. The only issue they have is the same issue a lot of companies, particularly in buy and build, and there's another one we're going to talk about in a moment, which is their equity is too cheap. So when they go, it's the whole thing I was talking about, the passive active thing, is that when they raise capital, the symbiosis isn't there because the providers of capital are just doing it passively. So there's no one out there going, oh, Brave Bison, they ought to be 7 pence a share, or it'll be 700 people they have their consolidation. They should be 7 pence a share. But they're only two. So with Brave Bison, want to raise equity. They end up overpaying for things because of their own equity is too expensive. Yeah. And it really messes up. It messes up capitalism, to be honest with you. Yeah. That's where the people that are pushing towards passives are anti-capitalists.
Yeah, maybe. Okay, another sector that's actually really, really cheap. We've got a question from Ben Sharman. He's asking about the recruitment sector in total, whether that's actually as a whole area is a busted flush. And one particular stock he owns is Robert Walters, RWA. I don't know if you've got, they're more of a generalist one, but when you look at the shares in the chart, they're really being slammed. I don't really got any thoughts about whether AI is replacing sort of like a large chunk of that recruitment, and particularly, things like LinkedIn, for instance.
I think they use LinkedIn as a tool, more or less. I don't really follow them that well, to be honest. I used to be a sports services analyst, and I used to have cover Hayes and stuff. The problem with these industries is the same problem you get with investment management and things like that, which is the real power lies with the revenue generators.
Yeah.
And it can be quite hard to maintain a kind of coherent staff structure when people are getting the best people are getting paid the most. And so it's like, they come in and they make more money, but they actually end up making more money for themselves rather than the company.
Yeah.
I don't have a strong view on recruiters, I'm honest. They're usually quite good yield stocks, though.
Yeah. I personally would say, Ben, I mean, I think the recruitment sector to me looks broken. And the reason why I say that is actually we've had quite a strong, low unemployment rate for 3 or 4 years. And if you actually, go back and look at these stocks, they haven't performed at all, for ages and ages, any of them. And even though a lot of people have been, people are getting recruited out, a lot of them outside of these specialists. So I think you need to be very specific and understand the model, because there's something happening there that's actually taking a lot of volume away from what you would do third party recruiters. So it just doesn't smell right to me, but hey ho. Okay, we've got Alan. He's basically asking about another company that's gone through the mill, Focusrite, which basically does professional audio and video. Again, was a darling during the lockdown when everybody wanted to upgrade their home, video and productions and this sort of stuff. They've gone through again another real problem. Is this a turnaround opportunity or is it a sort of value trap?
I think so. On Focusrite, incidentally, I have written that up. I have a little Substack called Wonderstuffs, and I wrote it up in, I think, February or March. I called it. I don't know what I called it, but Focusrite is a good business. It's a lot better business than people think, but it's so funny because the businesses that were huge beneficiaries of lockdown, and it doesn't matter what sector it's in, they've got killed since the end of lockdown. And the problem was, is I remember, it's a different sector, but I remember in the middle of 2020 seeing an article in the FT, and it was a small business in London that sold bikes for commuters, but quite high-end bikes. And they sold one a week typically. And they said since lockdown had started, they were selling 100 a week or something mental like that. Yeah. And it's basically the same thing happened at Focusrite. They went from selling a little bit of podcasting gear to masses and masses of podcasting gear. And what that means is you've got this huge overhang for all these people that either wouldn't have bought it in the first place or were thinking of buying it, but would have bought in 2 years' time or 3 years' time, all bought it at the same time. And it meant we've ended up going through this horrible destocking cycle. So I think they peaked about 18 quid. And what are they now? £1.40.
Yeah.
Mental. They are, historically, they're a 40% return on capital business. They won't be a 40% return on capital business in the future because they overpaid for some acquisitions. But they are a pretty good business and they do generate decent returns on capital. Phil Dudderidge is the chairman and founder. He's got like 33% of it. I think the CEO knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
Once you get through this destocking cycle, and they have talked in the most recent couple of trading updates that they are seeing signs of some sort of return to normality in customer upgrade cycles, then suddenly I think people will look at Focusrite and think, wow, that's a cheap stock. Because your returns on capital have probably gone down to about 15% now. They could easily hit like 25%. You do that on higher revenue. So it's 25%. You do that on higher capital because they're continuing to invest. And you apply a slightly less stingy multiple. And suddenly £4, £5, £6 a share looks perfectly fine.
Mm.
You know, it's interesting. I saw I think 2022, Keith Ashwood Lord had been interviewed somewhere. And he was sort of fund manager of the moment back then. And one thing he said is Focusrite had fallen to 10 quid from 18. Mm. And he said, I can buy this fantastic business at almost half the price. So why wouldn't I?
Mm.
There's a bit of a lesson there, because the reason you might not is because it can carry on falling a lot further than they are. But right now, I mean, I'm sort of waiting on the technicals to turn around a bit, because, you know, I wrote this up when they were about 180. They've declined another 20-odd% since then. Mm. I would wait until they look like they're flatlining and then both hands full.
Does it have any recurring revenue streams, that? I mean, you know, if it's just basically capital, then it's a pretty tough gig, to perfect guys, against the cheap Chinese and Vietnam sort of electronics.
They do have a software thing, but I don't know if it runs as a SaaS or whether it's once only. I'm sure there must be a small element of it, but it's not a big part.
Okay. All right. Cool. Okay. We've got a question from Emma, topical company, actually, in the news today. Camellia, basically, that I think is a specialist in, well, basically, it does agricultural businesses and assets around the world, tea and avocados and wine, well, basically white grapes and blue, all kinds of different sort of agricultural. But it's going through, as you mentioned it last time, is going through a sort of a value creation or turnaround strategy. How do you see this? We're still loss-making, but it's sort of like trying to realise some of the value in its assets.
Yeah, it's interesting. They're having a value enhancement presentation right now as we speak. They announced it on the 5th of May, and it was at 10 a.m. today.
Yeah.
But they released this morning. Talking and it's, I mean, it's not much of an interesting value enhancement program. They're basically going to try and operate more efficiently.
Mm.
Yeah, you see that pop today because they've also announced that they're doing a tender offer for, I think, about 13% of the equity.
Yes, that's right.
Because they're stupidly cheap. I mean, on a net asset value, anywhere between about 150 and £200 a share, and they're currently 50 quid. I talked about them last time. Like, they're a weird Victorian throwback that's beginning to turn itself into a proper business.
Yeah.
Something I haven't quite appreciated before, but you know, their old headquarters was a stately home. You would talk to any kind of old aristocrat type who's asset rich and cash poor, and they'll tell you those things cost an absolute fortune to run.
Mm.
Plus, they had this art collection, stamp collection, all this kind of stuff. And that would all cost a fortune in insurance. So the fact they've sold all that off actually means there's quite a good low hurdle to step over. And they can cut out a bunch of central costs that related to running things. They shouldn't have been running in the first place. This value enhancement plan, they're going to make acquisitions where they make sense, whatever that means, and they're going to try and invest in operational improvements. I suspect they're going to go from being a rubbish business to a below average business. But going from being a rubbish business to being a below average business, when you're priced like a rubbish business, can still make quite a lot of money in quite a short period of time if it goes right. And this,
you sold it to me there, Jamie. That's the best investment theory case I've ever heard.
It's never going to be a great business, but you know,
it's a cigar butt, basically. That's what you're saying. Cigar butt. Yeah, okay. Now, the question comes down to, I suppose, when you look at this, and yes, it's trading at significantly less than tangible asset value because it's got all the land. If for some reason their plantations for the various crops stay loss-making because other plantations around the world have got cheaper and sources and they can sell at lower price. So these ones they've got are loss-making. What is actually the value of that land that they have those plantations? Because you probably can't sell them at all for alternative use. I mean, you can't start putting houses in a swamp or in a tea up a a hill and stuff.
That's a great question. One thing I would say though about Camellia is it is the largest tea grower in the entire world. It's not just one of many, and it's the eighth largest. It is the biggest one. It is the dominant force out there. So I suspect it is that thing where they just. I think they said this morning they've spent an average of about $7 million a year on maintenance capex, and that really needs to increase to more like $10 million, because I suspect they're probably running some old, not very good equipment, and it's not very efficient as a result. It's that classic thing. They just need to invest in it. I wouldn't hang around with it for a long period of time now. And I do actually own it a little bit of it. I don't have a lot, but 80, 90, 100 quid a share, I'd be out. Which, from here, is 100 quid a share is still 100. It's still 100% return. So it's not like a.
I agree. Yeah, no, I know. Okay, good. Let's move. We've got Neil, similar sort of area, but basically, it's a company called Agronomics, which I understand is an investment company in sort of like protein. Basically, he's trying to come up with substitutes for animal protein and it's sustainable, etc. Got a bunch of investments. I think is it run by a quite iconic investor, and I can't remember his name. Mellon, is it, or somebody? I can't remember. Jim Mellon, yeah. Anyway, what's sort of the investment thesis here, and do you own it, and what's the upside?
Well, I have a lifetime ISA, which I don't know why I opened. I never really needed it because I used my pension, but I did open one more, and I stuck Agronomics in it. The way I look at Agronomics, like you say, it's an investment vehicle. It's not just animal proteins. It's not just like, what do they call it? Like that fake meat stuff. They do all sorts of stuff. Jim Mellon.
Beyond meat, it was.
Yeah, that kind of thing. They don't own that, but that kind of thing, like making synthetic meats and stuff, which I'm a bit icky about, but some people like that. But Jim Mellon is he's getting on. I think he must be pushing 70, and he's very, very rich. He started in the city in 82. I don't think he was poor, because he is part of the Mellon family, as in the New York banking family.
Is he?
Yeah, they are. He is related somehow. Right, I think I think he went to private school and things like that. So he's not from a poor background. He's Scottish, I think. But he don't sound it. Which is how you know he's posh, because Scots who don't sound Scottish are usually posh. But he's self-made billionaire. And he's the largest private landowner in the Isle of Man. He's a bit of a maverick. And I think he set up Agronomics because he thought, I'm getting a bit older and I'd quite like to live to be 150 or something. Right, so he set up this thing. It's mainly actually about longevity stuff. Mm. So he all advocates all this kind of microdosing of aspirin and stuff like that, because it's like a very slight blood thinning and it helps or something. I don't know. Mm. But the way you look at Agronomics is it's a portfolio of lottery tickets for the future of health.
Yeah.
And like most lottery tickets, expire worthless. Yeah. But if they do come in, they can make an awful lot of money. So the way you see Agronomics is it's effectively a venture capital vehicle. I read a book last year by Nate Silver called On the Edge, and it talked about the economics of venture capital, where it's basically, if you do a portfolio approach, it turns out at like 16, 17, 18% per annum, which is quite good. But how it comes is you have lots and lots and lots of things that expire worthless, and then you hit one that's a thousandfold.
Yeah.
And the idea why you own a little bit of Agronomics is one of the things in there could be worth a thousand times its current valuation, in which case you'll do okay eventually out of it. It's an interesting business. There's a very interesting person, Jim Mellon, as well.
Yeah. Very interesting. The whole sector, though, is massively competitive in terms of substitutes and stuff. I mean, there's so many businesses, whether they're profitable, as in like profit-generating businesses and non-profits, there's just like so much money going into it that to be able, I mean, not only you do you may spread your portfolio over 20 investments and one goes to the moon, but actually, rather than the 20 you put in, there's thousands of other people doing the same sort of thing in other businesses, and it becomes a really, really low probability bet, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. And I guess you're hoping that Mellon and his team around him have got the mouse to work out which ones are the better ones. I mean, you just don't know. I mean, you would never have a lot in it.
Yeah.
Same way you would never have a lot in Bitcoin. It's the same sort of investment, really.
Yeah. Just on that broader question, in terms of portfolio construction, I know that's for sort of like the venture capitalist. What's your sort of like portfolio construction? Mine tends to be that I go for sort of like 15 to 20 high concentrated stocks, largely in small caps, but there's maybe occasionally a few, you know, mid caps, and then run it over 3 to 5 years. I don't trade, but I just, you know, look for that type of that value and hopefully get, well, I've tended to got sort of 60% sort of hit rates and more winners, as like higher, more money I would make for the winners than lose. What about you? What's your sort of like portfolio construction theory?
My view sort of cleaves towards, I think it was Charlie Munger that said it, which is no one ever got rich investing in their seventh best idea. With that in mind, I mean, I probably end up owning like 15 to 20, but I aim at owning as few as possible.
Yeah.
And being concentrated in the areas where I think there's a very special potential investment outcome.
Yeah.
I don't know if you ever followed Nick Sleep with his Nomad thing. He was a fund manager from 2003 to 2011. And he was, I never heard of him at the time, but he's become a legend since he retired because he's got all these old notes he wrote. And his final Nomad letter, because the fund was called Nomad, he basically said, if you're selling, no, you are selling, I'll tell you what I'm doing with my money if you want to know what to do with your money. And he basically said, buy three stocks, put a third of your money in Amazon, put a third of your money in Costco, and put a third of money in Berkshire Hathaway. Now, I couldn't do that, but he was bang on.
It all depends on which ones you select. I mean, I mean, a really sort of concentrated sort of two or three stock portfolio is really for the very brave, and, you know, don't bet all your savings on them would be my take. I mean, I would personally say if you're a broad, experienced investor who can take risk tolerance, then you've got to accept that something's going to blow up occasionally. And if you're prepared to lose 10% of your portfolio in a day on a stock, which not many people are, in terms of as a big knock, and that's the sort of like, you know, 10 is a sort of like the lowest level you want to take a hit on, would be my take. But I mean, what's your biggest loss you've ever taken, Jamie?
In a day, it was Vistry, actually. In percentage terms, I probably only had about 5% in it, but it fell about 40 in a day.
So
I think I've got bigger holdings than that.
Yeah, I always say you only really know your risk tolerance when you blow through it, okay? And when have you blown through your risk tolerance over your 20-year degree, you know, career? Because that tells you how many stocks you're comfortable in holding.
Yeah, I don't think I have. Maybe I've
been lucky, mate. You've been lucky.
I'm sure I probably have, but I don't think I have really blown through it. I mean, April was rough. You know, I lost a third of the value of my house in April, and I've made more back in the last 3 weeks because the market's been so volatile. If I'd stuck that in a tracker, I think the same thing would have happened.
Yeah.
No, you are right, but it effectively comes down to stock selection and conviction. I have a mental model I call 10 in 10 in my head, which is I'm trying to find equities that will compound at the rate that would allow me to multiply my capital by 10 times in 10 years, which is hugely ambitious.
Yes.
But my view is if I shoot for the stars, I might land on the moon.
Is that 25% compound each per annum? Is it
slightly over? It's 27.
Yeah, okay.
And it's, you know, I won't do it. I'd love to say I will do 27% per year, but I've at least aimed for it. What I do here, hopefully, will be a decent rate.
As long as you don't go super concentrated to achieve it, and then basically have a moment of truth, and then you realize.
No.
Yeah. I mean, what's the maximum level would you have one stock in your portfolio? Let's assume you do reach one which goes from 5% of your portfolio. What level, if it was doing really well, would you start trimming?
I don't really want to trim. I would buy up to about a 20. I think I bought up to 22% in Wise when I bought it at its cheapest. So 22% is the largest I've bought up to, but I've never sold it. And it's now probably about 29.
Of your maybe portfolio. I should trim
it. Yeah. But, and maybe I should trim it at some point, but I don't want to get in the way of compounding.
Yeah, okay.
When I think it can compound at a really high rate.
Yeah.
You know, I made the mistake in the past of being a value investor where you cycle out of the things that are getting expensive and go into the things that are cheaper. Mm-hmm. But you do end up just chopping your flowers and feeding your weeds if you're not careful.
Yeah.
And I just kind of want to let my flowers bloom.
Yeah, okay. No, that's fair, dudes. Okay, let's move to, let's go to distributor. We've got one which is going through a bit of a transformation itself. DCC was a bit of a darling. I know we chatted about it last time. Had three divisions, a healthcare, technology, and an energy. And it decided, when you mentioned last time, to move and concentrate on energy, 75% of its profit. Sold off its healthcare business for about a billion euros. So it did work pretty well. How do you see this one? Is it... Because obviously energy is a tough area as a distributor to long-term compound it, but it's obviously done. It did well in the past.
Yeah, that's the main thing. It did well in the past. It's classic buy and build, like 300 acquisitions.
Yeah.
And the main thing is you're buying less than, you're buying, you know, 6 to 8 times EV EBIT. Ideally less than that. Or EV EBITDA rather. They probably should trade on about 12 times EV EBIT, maybe 14 at a push. They were trading at 8 when we last spoke. They've come down since then, so they're probably less than 8 now. And as we both said back in January, when they sell the healthcare, they'll sell it for more than 8 times. And we were right, they sold it for 12.
Yeah.
So what's left is trading on even less than it was before. So it's probably more like 7 times at this point.
Yeah, I've put the numbers in, and it's basically less than 6 times EBITDA.
Is it really now? Less than 6?
Yeah.
And then at the same time, you've got a management team that, and they said it in 2022, we're going to double profits by 2030, which is, it sounds like quite a lot, but actually that's only 9% per annum. It's not massive.
Yeah.
But they are ahead of that. They're not saying how far they are ahead of it, but they are ahead of it because they have upped it a few times, and of the energy division. They have upped it in 2024. When they sell the tech business, that will go for more than, that'll probably go for 12 times as well. So then they'll be left with a business on like 5 times. It will probably still continue compounding profits at least 9% organically. Mm. You add in some smart acquisitions, of which they've made 300 in the last 30 years. So they know what they're doing.
Mm.
And you add it all together. And if it was on its old rating of 12 times, if it hits its profit target in 2030, if it continues to do its share buybacks, which it started doing with the healthcare proceeds, 100 million initially, then going to do another 600 million in a few months' time, assuming the share price makes sense, then I can make 250%+ in that quite easily in 5 years. And 250% per year for over 5 years is 1,000% over 10 years.
Yeah.
Because two lots of 250% is not 500, it's 1,000. It's about 1,000. It's not exactly 1,000. So that gets you to your 27% compound average growth rate.
Mm.
putting it another way, if it doesn't, if the share price stays where it is, but it does deliver on what they said they're going to do, it'll be on an EV EBITDA of about, well, probably less than three in 2030. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. At some point, the value has to come out of this.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it looks cheap. I guess it comes down to growth, doesn't it? This sort of energy growth, pricing. I don't know how it all works in terms.
There's not a lot of growth in there, to be fair. Yeah. There is some. There's not a lot there.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Okay, we've got a question from Vanu Kapoor. He's asking about SDI Group, which is basically an instrumentation business, I believe, if I remember rightly, for labs and for, you know, healthcare, but also for sort of high specialist stuff. I was just looking at the numbers. It trades at about 11 times, no, about less than going forward, about 10 times PE. The shares have really taken off of late. I don't know if you ever had a look at this, £71 million market cap.
I'll hold a little bit of it.
Oh, do you? Oh, okay, good. Great question.
Scientific digital imaging. So it's that tells you what it does. It makes like optic kind of equipment.
Yeah.
This is, again, it's another classic buy and build. They actually refer to themselves as a buy and build business. So they buy these little clever businesses and they combine them into this kind of coherent entity. They're a little bit like a miniature version of what Halma's done over the last 30 years.
Oh, right.
They are clever. They do good things in the sense of they make products that generate high returns on capital. They've got a competitive advantage. I think the reason they came off so badly is they had a slight issue where there was sort of a pullback in demand from laboratories and that kind of stuff.
Yes.
At the same time as you had the problems with IHT and AIM, because money has just been flooding out of AIM, and this was a classic AIM stock. And that's basically why I bought it. I think I certainly bought it in one of those dips. I don't know which one. So I probably paid about 50p or something for it, because I've looked at it for years, long admired it, and long thought, oh, that's too expensive.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't anymore. As it stands now, I think it's a fabulous business. I think it's well run, and I think it's very cheap.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the shares have responded really well since February, hasn't they? I mean, it's gone from roughly around about, 47p only a month ago to 74. So, April rally.
Figures out today, which were good as well.
Had what, sorry?
They had figures out today.
Oh, did they? Okay, excellent. Okay, brilliant. Well, we've been already going for nearly 70 minutes. Well, a question I ask all our experts here, Jamie. What's your sort of your favourite stock then for your next sort of 12 months, 18 months, maybe one we've talked about or another one?
Yeah, see, I'm hopeless at 12 months. I said to you DCC at the start of the year and it's gone down.
Don't worry. Give us, what's
on your stock? Because I think that they are doing things that make sense to kind of unlock the value. Whether the market pays attention to it or not, I don't know.
DCC, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right, brilliant. Well, thanks again, Jamie. Thanks, everyone, for your questions. Fascinating conversation, as always. And looking forward to hearing your what you've been writing about in Money Week and on your Substack, and catching up in about sort of 6 months' time.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks very much, Paul.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.